This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Thank you all for coming. You all win the award for coming to a Policy Wonk event on the nicest day of the year so far. So you've shown a commitment to seriousness already. I'm Ethan Rarick. I'm with the Institute of Governmental Studies. This is part of a year-long series of events, which actually will continue next fall semester, called Choosing the President. And with that, I will just very briefly introduce our moderator, and then he will introduce the panel. The moderator today is Stephen Shortell, who is the Dean of the School of Public Health here at Berkeley, also the Blue Cross Distinguished Professor of Health Policy and Management. And he is particularly well-suited to moderate this discussion in that his research focuses on many areas of health policy and healthcare management. Dean Shortell.
Thank you. Again, I want to echo what Ethan has said and welcome you here, competing with the weather, but it shows your real interest in this topic. It's one that affects all of us almost every day in our lives, one way or another. So let me just start out. Often when we think of healthcare systems worldwide, in our country and worldwide, we think of the issues of access and cost and quality. And just a reminder for all of us, in this country, we don't do very well at all on any of those three dimensions. If we look at access to care, we have still 47 million uninsured, probably going to increase given the nature of our economy. That amounts to about 18-20% of the population. It also, we're still the only Western industrialized nation that doesn't offer universal coverage in some form. We've known about this for decades. We are extremely costly. We are 16-17% of our gross domestic product. It's about $2.4 trillion. It continually outpaces inflation. And simply put, we're the most expensive system in the world. But we always thought we're getting value for our money, and yes, it'd be nice if we could spread it around to more Americans. But in the last 5 to 10 years, we've discovered we don't do very well on the quality front either. Specifically, a number of studies now have demonstrated that probably on average, we get recommended care across a variety of conditions slightly only over half the time. It's even less for our children. We have high rates of infections, and preventable medical errors. About 100,000 of us die each year from a preventable medical error, another 100,000 from an infection, a hospital acquired, and otherwise. Recent reports from the Commonwealth Fund, when you compare us on various statistics like these, as well as health status statistics, we are almost perennially dead last or very low down on the totem pole. This is a big issue, and I'd like to frame it and have us think about it a little bit in terms of value. What are we getting for the investment we're making? And if you put in the numerator of a value equation, quality metrics, patient safety metrics, satisfaction metrics, and then the denominator, the cost, the investment we're making, that's what we're talking about in terms of value. So the issue the panel is going to address is going to address all of these issues. They're interrelated. It's not just about expanding health insurance coverage. It's about long-run affordability and sustainability of that coverage and the kind of care that Americans receive, even if they have health insurance coverage. So we have to deal with the affordability and cost issue. The next president, if he or she is going to take this on, in addition to the war and the economy, we might have an interesting discussion as the health issue related to those other two issues, okay, is going to also have to deal with the delivery system, the financing of the system, the behavior of providers, the waste and the rework that's done within the system as well. And the major challenge that he or she's going to have, we have to think about, is how are we going to get enough buy-in from all the various stakeholders that are involved? And although we might voice our protest and concern for our American health system, For many of these stakeholders, it's also where they get their income, send their children to college, and some of these changes may hit them in the pocketbook. And I like to think of them in a simplified way as kind of the five P's, just to begin with. You have those who purchase health care, the employers in this country, major, major stakeholder. You have the plans or the health plans, often act as an intermediary purchaser, benefit package design, and so on. You clearly have the providers, both physicians, hospitals, nursing homes, others, nurse practitioners, and so on, as part of this. And you have the public in general, and then patients in particular. So all of them have a stake in the way things are now, as much as they might protest. And so how do we design and make some changes? How does the new president get the support of Congress if he or she wants to take on this issue? So to begin our discussion, I'm going to briefly introduce each of our panelists, and they will speak in this order. Helen Halpin is professor of health policy and management here at Berkeley in our School of Public Health, director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies, and is also one of Senator Obama's chief healthcare advisors. In fact, Helen will be leaving on the red eye tonight for Philadelphia. We also have with us Hal Luft. Hal is professor of health policy and health economics at the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies over at UCSF. He's also adjunct investigator at the Department of Healthcare and Policy Research at the Palo Alto Medical Foundation. And Hal just returned from Poland and Israel. I don't know if it was a red eye, but he feels as if it was a red eye. So we've got one going out and one coming in. The third panelist will be our colleague Mark Peterson, who's professor of public policy and political science at the School of Public Affairs at UCLA, political scientist, one of the leading political scientists addressing this issue, and has been past editor of the Journal of Health Policy, Politics, and Law. Now think of that, health policy, politics, and law. I think that covers all the sins that I know about. So Mark will elaborate on that. So we're going to begin with Helen.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve. I see many friendly faces and new faces, and thank you and welcome to all of you. As I'm sure you may be aware, the U.S. has been struggling to achieve some sort of universal health insurance coverage for about 80 years now without success. But I think this election cycle, we've changed the terms of the debate in trying to achieve universal coverage for all Americans in a way that I think is quite significant. What's different this year is, first, that there is incredible consensus in the Democratic Party for the first time that I can remember on what shape the reform should take. The last time we went round and round on this under the Clinton administration, there was huge disagreements in the Congress over whether we should go a single-payer route or those who wanted the managed competition proposal that the Clintons proposed or people who wanted other kinds of incremental reforms. But this time, at least among the leading Democratic primary contenders, there is enormous similarity across their plans. And these plans themselves are very different than the kinds of universal health care proposals that we've seen in the past. In the past, most of the solutions that were proposed were basically one-size-fits-all solutions to universal coverage, meaning that everyone in the country would go into this one new plan. So a single-payer for all would mean that everyone in the country would have to go into the single-payer system. An employer mandate, which Nixon had proposed before ERISA, would have required all employers to offer coverage to all employees with other kinds of government programs for those who don't have an employment link. The Clintons proposed a managed competition plan where they would set up regional pools and plans would compete within these pools for enrollment. But the plans this year don't look like any one of these, and in fact, in some ways look like all of them and more. This election cycle, what I think we are witnessing is a real paradigm shift In that the universal coverage proposals are much less about designing one program for the entire country and much more about enabling people to choose under what kind of system and what kind of plan they want to receive their care. Choice is really the overarching goal of these proposals at almost every level. As I said, the Clinton and Obama plans are nearly identical. I'll briefly address some of the differences, but we'll concentrate primarily on their similarities. And they both offer Americans the following under their proposals. Number one, if you are already enrolled in the Medicaid program or the state children's health insurance program, you'll keep your coverage in those programs. And in fact, eligibility for those programs will be expanded to cover more of the poor and more of the near poor. Two, if you're in Medicare, you'll keep your Medicare coverage, and both candidates have pledged to revise the Medicare Part D drug benefit so that the elderly have adequate coverage for their prescription medications and the government can negotiate on price with the pharmaceutical companies. Three, if you have employer-sponsored coverage and you like it and you feel it's adequate, you can keep it. Four, if you work for an employer who does not offer coverage, they'll be required to start offering it or contribute into a pool where you can find affordable and comprehensive coverage options. And five, if you A, work for a small firm, B, buy your coverage in the individual insurance market, C, are uninsured, and or D, have inadequate group coverage, you can go into a new pool where you'll have two choices. The first choice is that you can select among a menu of private plans modeled after the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, which is available to members of Congress and other federal employees. Or the second option is that you can enroll in what they call a public plan like Medicare, which is the new code for single payer, that would operate alongside the current system in much the same way the Medicare program presently does. The traditional Medicare program, as it was created in 1965, is in fact a single-payer system. Financing is pooled at the national level, and bills are paid, and enrollees can go to doctors and hospitals that accept Medicare payment. And then more recently, Medicare has also offered options of getting coverage in private plans. But about 80% of the Medicare beneficiaries remain in the single-payer part of the program, with about 20% of them electing to join a managed care plan. And many people believe that this may be a similar kind of breakout that we see should the Clinton or Obama proposals go forward. Basically, in the pool, if you're eligible to go into the pool, your premium will be subsidized, so it's affordable relative to your income. And there are differences in how Obama and Clinton approach these subsidies. Under Obama's proposal, they are direct premium subsidies, so that the premium that you pay out of your pocket every month is only your monthly share of the premium. Whereas Clinton, on the other hand, relies on refundable tax credits for her subsidies. What I think is most extraordinary about these plans, and largely overlooked by the mainstream media, is that they will actually enable the voluntary transition to a single-payer system in the United States. Now, just how this might occur, how quickly and how completely, is entirely a function of the economic incentives that the Congress ends up building into these plans. We could see if, for example, the payroll tax is set far below the current average that firms are paying, a massive move employers out of sponsoring insurance and putting their enrollees into the pool. If the payroll tax is about the same or higher than what they're currently paying, then we wouldn't see that effect. But we can pretty much model and design how quickly and how completely this transition would occur based on how we set these economic incentives. In a similar proposal that I developed for California a number of years ago and which I revised as a national plan, an independent analysis was conducted of the impact of a reform that offers the option of a single-payer system along with managed care options. And what it found was within 1 year of adoption of this option of a single-payer plan in the pool along with managed care options is that approximately 70% of the non-elderly population would be in the pool, with between 20 to 30% of the population enrolling in private plans and 40 to 50% enrolling in the single-payer plan, with the remaining 30%, remember these are non-elderly, in public insurance programs or employer-based coverage. Translated to the national level, this could mean that potentially more than 1 million Americans could get their care under a single-payer system within 1 year of implementation or adoption of these plans. Under such a huge pool, the potential for savings through reduced administrative costs, economies of scale in purchasing, and the ability to negotiate prices is potentially tremendous. The advantages of the single-payer plan for individual Americans are many and include having no insurance company interfering in decisions about your care or treatment, having the freedom to go to the doctor or hospital of your choice, and letting physicians practice medicine. And the best part of this approach is that no one is forced to enroll in the single-payer plan. You either can choose to enroll or not. Okay? This is very different than the models that we've seen proposed in the past. Now, it's estimated by economists that any comprehensive incremental reform strategy, which these proposals are, can get us to cover approximately 95% of the population. And this remaining 5% is the famous 15 million we hear Hillary Clinton talking about all the time when she says that Obama's plan will leave out 15 million people. The assumption is that her proposed solution to covering this last 5% will be 100% effective so that she will get to 100% enrollment, whereas her assumption with respect to Obama is that he will just leave these 15 million uninsured. Neither of those things are true. The truth is that neither of these plans are truly universal, as neither of them extend coverage to the 12 or 15 million undocumented workers and their families who live and work and go to school in our communities. In addition, there are many populations who I call the people who live in the shadows, who are the homeless, drug addicts, those who have an undocumented worker in their family and are afraid to sign up for a government program, who will most likely not be able to function under a formal insurance system, so that we will continue to need a very strong safety net for millions of people under either of these plans. The biggest concerns for many people looking at these plans are the potential problems of, one, free riders, who are people who could afford to buy coverage but choose not to. And the second is the problem of adverse selection, and that's the likelihood that only those who are sick will enroll in the pool. The solution proposed by the Clinton campaign is to try to get to 100% through an individual mandate to buy insurance. Clinton assumes she can achieve 100% compliance with her mandate. The problem with this proposal is that mandates are never 100% affordable, and experience suggests that perhaps as much as 20% of a population that's mandated to buy coverage might not, in fact, comply. In addition, the research is clear that monitoring enforcement must be very strong and the penalties must be very stiff in order to get people to comply, and Senator Clinton has not indicated how or even if she would monitor or enforce her mandate. In contrast, Senator Obama starts from a position of respecting individual liberty and autonomy of Americans and believes that we should set policy for the 95% of the Americans who want affordable health insurance and not for the 5% who may not enroll. He does not believe in a coercive command and control approach to getting to universal coverage, but rather pursues universal coverage within the framework of a human rights strategy. The role of the government in implementing a rights strategy is to protect people's rights from being denied and to ensure that their rights are met. It is not to punish people whose rights have not been met. Hillary's charge of 15 million left out assumes Obama will do nothing to help these 15 million people enroll. But in fact, under Obama's plan, no American is left out. The goal of Obama's plan is universal coverage, and every American will have the opportunity to find affordable coverage under his plan. But he offers a very different approach to trying to get these last 15 million covered. First, he will let adult children up to the age of 25 stay on their parents' family policies. The largest group of uninsured Americans is, in fact, this group of 19 to 29-year-olds who have fallen off their family's private coverage and who aren't getting coverage through school or through their jobs. Extending family coverage, I think, to this group is a much more humane and efficient way of increasing coverage. This is where we're likely to find free riders, than to try to track them down and force them to enroll in the program. The state of New Jersey, in fact, has raised eligibility for family coverage to age 30. My, aren't we extending our dependency? But this problem, estimates are, will go a long way towards addressing a big part of the free rider problem. Obama's also seriously considering a point of care enrollment where each person, when they came in for care, would be offered affordable insurance options. One way to encourage enrollment would be to make clear that if they don't sign up for insurance coverage when offered, they will be held responsible for the costs of the care they're about to receive. My guess is that many people, given those two choices, will probably elect to enroll for insurance. Approximately 67% of the uninsured seek care in a hospital, doctor's office, or emergency room every year, suggesting that it may be possible to enroll as many as 90% of those who don't sign up initially within the first 2 years. I'm almost done. I had a great conversation about a month ago with Ted Marmer at Yale about the concern about adverse selection in the pool. And he assured me that he thought as long as we kept Medicaid and Medicare as separate pools, that the effects of adverse selection would be minimal because the vast majority of the population going into the pool will be working people and their families who are generally healthy. If the two groups whose health status is the lowest, the elderly and the very poor, are not in the pool, at least not initially, a pool with hundreds of millions of people will be very large and likely to be very stable. Finally, I just want to say that the issue of the individual mandate to purchase insurance is a moot point in the Congress. And it is the Congress who will ultimately write the law. Senator Kennedy, who is a huge Obama supporter, has said that he wants to have a bill ready to be introduced immediately after the inauguration, and he has in fact been staffing up this week on his committee to begin to draft Obama's proposal into legislation. He has said publicly that the idea of an individual mandate is dead on arrival in the Congress, and that it will not be included in the Senate's bill. So there is little point in continuing to discuss the mandate and debate it, although I would be happy to engage those who feel strongly about it. I also just want to point out a few other features of Obama's plan that really stand out compared to the others. The first is that he's really aware of the importance of public health and has strong provisions for the planning for pandemic flu and strengthening our public health system that we don't see in the other proposals. He also understands the lack of access to care in rural areas and has proposed expanding the use of and availability of telemedicine. And he also understands the need to help employers keep their premiums down and is the only one to offer reinsurance for catastrophic costs for employers. So I have gone over all of this very quickly, but would be happy to answer any questions that you have, and thank you.
Thanks, Helen. We're going to go to Hal next.
Okay. I'm not affiliated with any candidate. In a sense, I'm trying to address what I would call the morning after question. The discussion has generally been on how do we get more people covered? And I'm saying, well, suppose that we got everybody covered. Would the system work the way you wanted it to? Would there be internal dynamics to get high quality, to get efficiency? Would there be ways in which you would have a wide choice of providers? Would there be ways in which physicians and other healthcare providers would not be driven crazy by dealing with literally hundreds of different benefit packages, plans, drug formularies, et cetera? I haven't seen any of that. I also think about it, particularly in this environment, it's relevant, the political issues. There are substantial issues and problems that I think need to be addressed in the context of any single-payer government-run program, basically because I don't trust the Congress. Or I trust the Congress, but I don't trust the lobbyists, which have an impact not just in writing the legislation, but in developing the regulations and the way in which things actually get enforced. And so I'm very concerned about any kind of unitary system. So what I'm trying to think about here is a way in which we can have the kinds of choice that are really important to Americans. And I would make an argument here perhaps for, I guess, what Mark and others would refer to as the American exceptionalism, that we can't use the system just because it works elsewhere, because, in fact, we're not like elsewhere. We don't have a parliamentary system. We don't have the kind of structures where we actually value bureaucrats. So what I've got is a very different approach. I'm asking, where do we really need coverage? We need it for hospitalization, the major acute and interventional kinds of problems, and we need it for chronic illness. Hospitalization, really expensive. People would buy insurance if they could get it at a reasonable rate. Chronic illness, people really need, but once they have a chronic illness, they can't buy it because of the selection cost. So we have a universal pool that covers everybody for hospitalization and chronic illness. Everything else, minor acute problems and preventive services, are a relatively small amount, about 30% of total expenditures, and don't vary a whole lot. You don't really need insurance. People will want it, and I'll come back to that in a moment. So how do we deal with the hospitalization? Basically, we bundle together in a DRG-like payment the payment for both the hospital side and the physicians, and we say, if you guys can get together and form a care delivery team, we'll give you a bundle of money. And what we'll pay is not a budget-neutral amount, but whatever it costs in terms of resources to provide above-average quality care. So the compact with the American public is we will pay for whatever it costs to give you high-quality care. But the incentives internally are for that care delivery team to figure out how to do it more and more efficiently because they get that bundled amount and they keep the difference. So they now have incentives to figure out what works, how to become more efficient, and how to restructure their system. Incentives that work outside of the political process of the specialty society saying, no, you need to do it this way because that's the way we keep ourselves employed. Chronic illness is important. Ongoing chronic illness management we need to deal with. And I'll get to that in a second. Let me jump down now to the outpatient side. So patients, people, before they're patients, would choose a primary care physician. Anyone they want. The primary care physician would have chosen a payment intermediary. There'll be a whole bunch of them out there competing. These could be reformed health insurers, Visa, MasterCard, Schwab, PayPal, anybody who's good at processing financial transactions, because there's very little risk involved. Because there's only one payment intermediary for each primary care physician, and they handle all the claims associated with that primary care physician's patients, they very quickly identify, A, which patients have a chronic illness. Having identified that, they let the universal coverage pool know, and the UCP pays them on a monthly basis the average amount for whatever the problems are that that patient has. So that goes into a pool that the payment intermediary holds. The payment intermediary then pays for all the services on a fee-for-service basis. That's what most doctors are used to. That's what they're comfortable with. Leave it. I'm not trying to change the system bureaucratically. I'm saying if you want to change, you can. And this thing works into Kaiser-type plans or multi-specialty group practices if you want. But you don't have to go there. The net cost after taking account of those chronic illness payments is what's left over from minor acute problems, preventive care, et cetera. That's what shows up as premium. The patient and the payment intermediary have total flexibility in selecting what kind of deductible, copayment, et cetera, they want. They've got a lot of flexibility there, and they will continue to figure out new and better ways to structure those premiums. But the premiums are relatively low because all the expensive stuff is handled by that universal pool. We can pay for this either fully tax-paid, some mixture of tax and mandates, and the mandates need to be income-based subsidies. The nice part about this, because it's handled in the background, is everybody has the same card. And everybody, when they go into the doctor's office, brings with them exactly the same fee. It is not a low fee if you're covered by Medicaid, a slightly higher fee if you're covered by Medicare, and something higher than that, which leads providers to discriminate. So from the provider's perspective, they have no idea what the subsidy is. There are other things that are built in so that there is the generation of information, all the information is a public good available for researchers as well, but for the payment intermediaries and others to figure out what works well, and they then pass that information back to the primary care physicians and the care delivery teams, and they move at it without the ability of the special interest to modify through regulation what will get paid for and what won't. That's the short version. Long version coming out this fall. Okay.
That's the book, right?
That's the book.
Yeah, great. Okay, thanks, Hal. Mark?
I'm at
formally tied to any candidates, and I'm not going to put forward a particular proposal. What I'm going to try to do is talk a little bit about the context in which the next president, whoever he or she may be, will be operating along with the Congress and facing, quite cruelly, as has already been evident in the enthusiasm for talking about restructuring the system. We'll be dealing with health care reform. We'll also be dealing probably with Medicare. Medicare has been the big beast on the horizon in a way, and one of the things that's interesting about the next presidential term is the first baby boomers will begin to enter the Medicare program and raise symbolically at least the long-term issues. But what I want to do is set the context for 2009, turning to both kind of the issue context and the political context and how they come together, and make four basic points, and I'll try to do it very quickly. The first point is to build on what Steve said at the outset about what is often called, as he did, access, costs, and quality. I like alliteration, so I call them coverage, costs, and consequences. But they're all the same thing, and here's what I want to emphasize. We conventionally talk about the United States, how we've had healthcare reform debates for 80 years, and we've always failed. And that's true. But they've been very different debates under very different circumstances. And what I would pose now is to say the question, why is this time different from all other times? And by that, I mean, if you go back and you look at coverage, you look at costs, you look at consequences, for a long time in American history, one of the reasons why healthcare reform went down to defeat is that, in fact, coverage was expanding, expanded very dramatically and rapidly in a sustained, monotonic way until we hit the mid-1980s. It really wasn't until the reform debates in the 1990s that we started seeing coverage go down. And now we have even further confirmation this many years out that coverage is going to go down, it's going to go down, it's going to go down, and there's nothing about the organization, the economy, or the system that's going to reverse that. That's a profound change, and it's only going to get worse over the next 4 years, the next administration. Second, as Steve said, we are wallowing in costs. We are an enormously expensive system. We have all kinds of evidence of that. It really wasn't until the 1980s that we had clear evidence that we were an outlier in those terms internationally. And so that began to feed into the 1990s debate. Now we know it in spades. Every other country that has a different kind of system is doing a much better job on the cost side. It's unrelenting. It's undeniable. And it comes after the last big round of market change revolution through the managed care process that in the end did not provide the kind of controls that were needed on costs. In terms of consequences or quality, Steve laid it out very nicely. I just want to mention one particular point, two particular points. One is we didn't really know this stuff about our international comparisons on quality, for instance, until after the last reform debate. We now have information we just never had before. Now we really know. You can only, if you're a politician, you can only be stupid, ignorant, or a liar if you still make the comment, the U.S. has the best healthcare system in the world. There's just no way to empirically make that statement without having to do something with magic along the way. A study that was done of 19 countries, both in the 90s and more recently, on amenable deaths, deaths that should be or could be averted by appropriate medical care. The United States in the 90s came 17th out of 19. We're now 19th out of 19, and we're the country that's done the least well in making progress. All these other systems with different kinds of arrangements have made greater progress. So just in terms of the issues themselves, it's very hard now to say that we don't have a problem. We've got a problem in all three areas. They're not going away. They're only getting worse. Second point, Medicare cannot be divorced from the healthcare reform debates. We're going to have to deal with Medicare. We're going to have to deal with these issues in the overall healthcare system, and here's where they come together. Medicare is the canary in the mine shaft. We have established Medicare, and because we've established Medicare, we actually have an accounting system that tells us when we're in trouble. We can look at what the numbers are going to be in terms of growth and costs, and we can say that's a problem. The rest of the system does not have any transparent accounting system, and it goes on as though people talk about it as though it's still working. The system overall is in as much trouble as Medicare, and Medicare, the problems with Medicare are often ascribed to the baby boom. Well, certainly the baby boom is going to expand the number of people in Medicare, but the fact of the matter is most other countries who spend much less than we do already have a population that has a demographic profile we're going to have 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the road. The director of the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, has shown that the real cost drivers in Medicare and Medicaid is not the demographic change. That's more or less manageable. It's the healthcare cost increase that goes up exponentially and cannot be controlled. You cannot control that within Medicare without figuring out a way to control that within the overall system. Third point, since the last healthcare reform debate, alluding a little bit to what Steve talked about and Hal talked about, we know a lot more now about what affects health. And it turns out it's really not so much medical care and health care. Those are important. Those are essential. When you're sick or hurt, that's the last refuge you have to be brought back to quality of life. But the most things that affect health status are outside of the medical care system. We know that much better now. We're expending enormous resources on the medical care system. The next president, the next Congress are going to have to try to figure out ways in which we can move investments into areas and make some policy changes in areas that allow us to create healthier communities, allow us to create incentives and opportunities for people to have healthier behaviors, the whole range of things that, in fact, will affect health status. Fourth point, whatever is going to happen is obviously going to depend fundamentally on what happens in the election, the 2008 election. The 111th Congress, who's president, where we go is going to be entirely determined by the outcome of that election. Now, you'll notice one thing. No one has mentioned the name up here, John McCain. You may have heard about this guy. He's the Republican nominee running for president. Healthcare people don't tend to talk about him, in part because there is no John McCain healthcare plan. Quite frankly, he's on board in a way with these larger preventive efforts and trying to change the ways in which we think about producing health, which could be a way to break free of some ideological constraints of the past. But the fact of the matter is, I don't think anything would really happen under a McCain administration and a Democratic Congress, or very, very little except more and more infighting on these issues. And he frankly said in response to a reporter's question that in his ideal world, government would have no role in healthcare. That is really what he would perceive as the most advantageous situation. And so any direction he moves in is going to be pretty minimal in terms of using the public sector to guide any kind of policy action. The one thing I will say right now, and then I should close, is the debate going on between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. They are very close on a lot of issues, as Helen said. What really concerns me is that we are in a period of campaigning and not legislating. And yes, it's very important to be able to set an agenda. As Helen and I exchanged an email, John Kingdon, who wrote about agenda setting, you really have to take these windows of opportunity, be able to move with them very quickly. That's all very true. But what happens when you get into a debate about the microscopic details of these proposals, as though you are writing a bill? One is you're flying 35,000 feet over the head of most of the American public. Two, you're making the assumption that somehow we can't do anything unless the public agrees on each, every microscopic detail. And three, you lock in the policymakers who have to take the context of 2009 and that political context and figure out how to achieve the core values and principles they set out. And one of the problems with the Clinton plan is that we knew there was a memo on January 23rd, 3 days into the administration, Clinton administration, 1993, that said, here's what our health plan is going to be. Now we have to figure out how to do it effectively. And it meant that you couldn't engage in the kind of discourse and negotiation and compromise that might actually have led to a bit more beneficial outcome. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. I think what we're going to do is ask you now to get ready with your questions. You have cards in front of you and pass those to the aisles. And while you're doing that, I'm going to ask our panelists if you want to, make some further comments. I have a couple questions as well, but I'll open it up for our panelists. Helen?
I wanted to actually comment on something that Hal said in his suggestion that we don't need insurance coverage for preventive care. I agree we don't need insurance in the traditional sense of that word, in that it is not an unexpected or potentially catastrophic expense. We pretty much know it routinely has to be provided. The costs aren't that much. So it doesn't meet the provisions of the insurance model. But our experience is clear that if people even have to pay as much as $5 for their mammogram, they are less likely to get it. So that the function of insurance for preventive care is more one of prepayment, so that at the time of seeking care and accessing care, there isn't a financial barrier. So I don't know how, I wonder, I guess my question for you is, how do you make sure that we don't lose all the gains that we have through pretty comprehensively covering clinical preventive services, which has been a gain really only within the last 15 years, and not lose all of that?
Right. And I fully agree. And I think most people will prepay. Most of the policies that will be offered will have that. The kind of thing that I worry about is the following. And since you mentioned mammography, I think that's a very good example. So let's say we mandated coverage for mammography. What does that mean? We mandate coverage for digitally assisted mammography, which is what GE would have wanted. We now know that the digitally assisted mammography is not as good
or any better
and much more expensive. So a piece of what I'm trying to do here is to say, yes, people are going to have coverage for it. The vast majority, remember, the income subsidy that I'm putting into this is very high, you know, can be very high. That's the political decision. But what I don't want is for the Congress to be in there arguing about whether we cover the GE version or not. Okay? So that's why I'm saying I'm leaving that piece of it out, not that it won't be covered, but that I just want to move away from the political issues that happen when people are really just fighting about what goes into the benefit package.
Comments, the panel? Okay, we have a great group of questions here. So let me start off. These are in no particular order, but I'll start with this one. Is there a continued role for state health reform efforts? Or does it make more sense to wait for a federal solution given constraints like ERISA? And for, people might want to explain ERISA a bit. So the question is really about the role for state health reform, or does it make more sense to wait in terms of federal reform? And we know the experience here in California, Massachusetts, also in a few other states. So, Mark, do you want to lead off on that one? And everyone
sure.
might want to comment.
For those who are not, don't sleep, live, breathe, and sleep, the acronyms of the healthcare world, ERISA is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, which had as a provision, it was put in at midnight in the conference committee, that any health and welfare plan for a company that self-insured itself couldn't be regulated by the states. And so that meant that large businesses now, most of them, and actually many small businesses who self-insure the risk, can't have their benefits regulated by state governments. And that's getting to be around 50% of all employees are covered. That means it's very hard if you're a state to actually do a lot of big changes on the healthcare front because you don't have the authority now. You're preempted by federal regulation, and there is really no federal regulation, so that's kind of left open to a world. Now, should states still try, as Massachusetts has tried, California seemed to be on the verge, other states have gone? In part, yes, because it is a way in which the issue stays alive. It's a way in which the politics moves forward. It's a way in which ideas are discussed and sometimes tried out. Massachusetts, for better or worse, and I think probably I'm a skeptic for worse, will show us that that's not exactly the best way to go about creating an effective and efficient health insurance system of using multiple paths and a mandate. But it can be helpful. On the other hand, right now we know that we have a federal window opening up. And it would seem to me that the most energy over the next couple of years ought to be focused on Washington and not the states, because that's really where we have the impetus. And if we fall back again, then we can move into another period of state-level experimentation.
The only thing I'd add on that is I think the role for the states ought to be on experimentation around the remaining safety net issue. And I think Helen really put her finger on it. There are a whole bunch of people, small proportion, still in the millions, who won't be well dealt with through the insurance system and would never be covered under any legislation because, quote, they're not here. But more importantly, I think the states can take the lead on the true health promotion activities in terms of exercise, diet, school-based programs, those sorts of things that are outside of the medical care. And that's where I'd like to see 50 state laboratories going.
Okay, here's two related questions, both related to public health. One mention was made of Senator Obama is aware of the importance of public health. At what level of funding for public health is he aware, quote unquote? And related to that, Professor Peterson, you mentioned policy incentives to create healthier communities. How do we do that? So, Helen, you may want to comment on Obama and Mark on healthier communities.
Yeah. He is aware that we probably only spend about 1% of our total healthcare budget in the U.S. every year on what are called population-based prevention measures, which include public health and community-based health promotion and disease prevention efforts. It really hasn't changed at all since we had the last debate in 92 and 93 and 94. What is happening right now is the work that was done back in the early 90s is being resurrected since not much has changed. And there was an amazing coalition of public health and prevention advocates in the 90s who suggested that we spend at least 3% of total health expenditures on population-based public health and prevention. And my sense is that Kennedy staff will be working with that number and trying to incorporate many of the progressive and more innovative provisions around supporting the infrastructure in public health, more support for community-based interventions, as well as making sure that there's good coverage for all the clinical preventive services.
Yeah, healthier communities, very good question, a complicated issue, a couple things to suggest right now. One is there's an emerging analytical technology which is being applied in Europe and is starting to penetrate the United States called health impact assessments. And interestingly, across the bay in San Francisco, there is actually an effort to incorporate health impact assessments in things like urban renewal or urban redevelopment so that when you're tearing down buildings and where poor people live and disrupting their communities to build a different kind of housing, one of the things that you think about is what is the impact on that community of the disruption of the community and what is the health impact? It turns out it has health consequences for people to lose their community. So one thing is at the state level, the local level, the national level, to develop a capacity to assess all kinds of policy changes that would affect a community in terms of its impact on health, just as we do often in terms of its impact on environment, on the environment. The other is, of course, for the states and local governments in particular, maybe with some facility and incentives from the federal government, to do more to work on things that we know are very vital to staying healthy. One is to have parks and opportunities for people to have recreation. One is, frankly, to have safe communities, have safe neighborhoods. Parents don't send their kids out to play when they think it's more dangerous for them to be on the street than to be in front of a television set. Another thing, and this is where public policy gets very difficult in this society because it sounds too paternalistic, too big brotherish, is we have a basic problem with the distribution of what kinds of foods are available in different communities. There are a lot of communities who do not have grocery stores that have fresh vegetables. They don't, or the vegetables and fruits. Here's one thing we do nationally. We have a big farm bill. And what does that farm bill do? Among many other things, it subsidizes corn and subsidizes cornstarch. So the things that are really cheap, very cheap calories, are the things that are really bad for you. There is no subsidy for carrots and lettuce and broccoli and asparagus and all those other things that we'd actually like people to eat. Imagine a world in which the farm bill subsidizes fruits and vegetables and it doesn't subsidize corn production and corn syrup. There's a guy did a wonderful test once. He said, what could I buy with a dollar bill if I went into a grocery store? And it turns out, how many calories could I buy? You can buy the most calories by going through the middle, the most accessible part of the grocery store, which is all cookies, chips, and everything else is full of these fairly empty calories.
Just to comment also, I mean, what Mark and Helen's response to this, it makes it much more challenging for the next president administration because we're really getting into cross-sector issues. It's not just about health. It's about transportation. It's about labor. It's about housing. And, you know, those are all issues that contribute to health in a fundamental way. And some people have said perhaps the best thing we could do to improve the health of our country is to make sure every child can read by the age of 5. And so maybe we, if we could, take some of the dollars, if we had a more cost-effective health system and the political will to transfer those over to our educational system, it would be a two-for-one solution. That's at a very high level. But let me also extend the conversation a little bit and bring in some of Hal's idea about payment reform that could also influence community health. What if, in terms of bundled payments, you didn't just talk about hospitals and doctors, give them a bundled payment to manage diabetes or whatever. Instead, you gave that money to the local health department that ostensibly is closer to community-based health organizations, is working with the schools, is working on some of these safety issues and so forth and so on, and said, in effect, we're going to capitate, let's just say, Berkeley. It's going to go to the Berkeley City Health Department. This is the amount of money. We'll risk adjust it, et cetera, et cetera. These are the outcomes we're going to look at. And guess whether or not the hospitals and physicians in Berkeley wouldn't start talking with the health department and vice versa. Kind of a radical idea, but it gets more at a little bit closer to some of these community, social, and environmental determinants of these conditions than just the medical care after the fact care of these conditions. Okay, well, let's move on. To improve healthcare in the United States, our primary care infrastructure needs investment significantly. How would any of the candidates' ideas do this? So this is the fact we have a shortage of primary care physicians in this country. And it's interesting, I was at a meeting earlier today in which this came up. Many of these other countries that we get compared to have a much stronger primary care base than we have here in the U.S., and therefore they manage the patient populations very, very differently. So people want to comment on that?
I'll start. I think if everyone has coverage, the market will start to respond. But unfortunately, it takes about 6 years, at least postgraduate, to train a primary care physician. The alternative, which is resisted in many parts of the country by physicians, is to increase the training of nurse practitioners who require only 2 additional years of training following a baccalaureate degree. And I think there's a political problem, though, with with saying we're going to produce an army of nurse practitioners who will be providing primary care that has been traditionally provided by the physicians. Obviously, we need to change the incentives. The payment incentives are all towards going into specialty care. That's where you can make all the money. The prestige in academia is all in the specialties. I think oftentimes the most altruistic individual who goes into medical school thinking they want to be a primary care doctor often gets seduced by the glamour and resources available to specialty care physicians. So we have a real problem. And in other countries, I think we're almost the flip, aren't we, in terms of our ratio of specialists to primary cares? We need to literally turn it on its head. And there's no question that's going to take time, and there's no question that we're going to have a serious problem. Massachusetts right now is finding they simply do not have enough doctors to take care of all the new people enrolled in the system, and they haven't even enrolled half of those who they're hoping to.
One of the concerns I have, and this goes back to the single payer model, Medicare has made the primary care physician problem worse rather than better. And part of it is because it's politically almost impossible to shift the relative payments within the structure. So instead, everything gets pushed down in order to stay within budget constraints. Part of what my little proposal would do is it's primary care provider oriented. That's where the patient starts. Primary care provider can charge whatever he or she wants and may end up finding that, gee, a little more telephone time with specialist consultants gets me as much information as sending my patient to the specialist and having that MRI done. That's moving money around very quickly. I think we also need to have some very quick approaches to changing the pipeline in medical education to both deal with the issue of retraining and to deal with the problem of the very long pipeline, and therefore, if you develop too much medical debt going into education, then right now, until people figure out that primary care is where the money is going to be, we need to have ways to deal with that. So, again, there are ways to do it, and it's in Chapter 8.
Yeah, Mark?
Yeah, if I could just add a little bit. One is to emphasize what Steve said about this as well. Barbara Starfield's work shows that not only do we spend a lot more because we have so many specialists, but we actually get lower quality care compared to other countries because we have so many specialists. So ironically, by having such a highly trained, specialized medical care system, we actually get worse outcomes comparatively. In response specifically to the question, I think all three candidates are committed to primary care. How deeply they've thought about that is open to question. I think it's pretty obvious that we need a better primary care system, and they're all resonating with that. And that, again, may be a new opportunity to break free of some old ideological divides, although they'd be different about on what role government might play. The last thing I would say, though, is that the conversation really has still been entirely within the medical model. And one of the things we know now is that what we'd really like to have is a primary health system in which there are medical providers who are connected to other kinds of providers, teachers, social service providers, senior citizen centers, and various other things, because so much of what goes on in the quality of life happens at that level, and have communication from schools to doctors to nurse practitioners to social service workers of various kinds would allow people to have actually a better, more complete package of care. And we're a long way from really figuring out how to do that, except Connecticut is one place where they have an experiment in place where there really are those kinds of communications going on across medical and non-medical providers. Brings in the healthcare, brings in the states again as a source of experimentation.
Great. This question is specifically for Hal. So this is a targeted question here. It says, for Hal. If fixed amounts, you ready? If fixed amounts were paid to physicians and hospitals and incentives for public health, et cetera, to make care efficient, how is it that, and they can keep the leftovers, okay, if they do that, how can you keep the quality of care from deteriorating due to cutting corners, et cetera?
That's a softball down the
heart center of the plate.
Constant assessment of outcomes. And I want to push the notion here of focusing much more on outcomes than on process. Clinicians like to say, well, hold me to the standards of what I ought to be doing in a particular situation. And I'm thinking, no, let's see what works best for the patient. You look at, for example, patients who have a heart attack, you risk adjust, which we can do, 30-day mortality rates. You identify those care delivery teams that have the best mortality rates, highest, you know, in the top half, and that's where you start setting your payment levels. You also know who those organizations are, and you can make that public. No one's going to want to be in the bottom half. They're going to start asking, how do we get into the top half? How do we improve our quality? So the notion here is of transparency, continued collection of information. The physicians and the healthcare providers and the hospitals will immediately say, well, it's not risk-adjusted well enough. And the answer will be, tell us what you want to include. They did it in New York. They raised those issues. They added the variables. It got better and better and better. And so the notion here is simply to say, let's measure quality and provide the incentives for it to be better and to keep it transparent. The other piece of it is I don't think there are very many clinicians who really want to provide poor quality care. They just don't know how to do it. And there are ways in which we can help them.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.